Hi there. Today I'm here with Elena Berger. She is a software engineer based out of Zurich. Based on her LinkedIn profile, she has a couple of experience with small startups and larger companies, has worked for companies including like Canonical, Google, and latest Microsoft. So I'm very excited to talk to you, Elena. How's it going?
Great. Thanks for inviting me, Bas. Excited. Yeah.
So let's see if we have any more audio troubles. I hope not. But anyway, like I mentioned it briefly, you have quite an impressive CV on LinkedIn. Could you give us like a brief overview of your career steps?
Yeah, to the extent that any of it is impressive, it's just a function of being old. So I've been around for a long time and gained many experiences. But yeah, I started in the 90s. When the PC revolution and then the internet happened, and I kind of got sucked into software and got fascinated by it. And from there, I discovered open source and Linux and Emacs and Lisp and all kind of cool things like this. And this is it. I was doomed. I also traveled a lot, kind of moved from place to place. So I grew up in Israel, in Tel Aviv. But then I spent some time in Berlin in Germany in the 90s. A very exciting time.
And a very exciting city.
Yes. Later on in New York, just in time for the end of the dot-com bubble, leading development at a real dot-com startup. And eventually for many years in London, now in Zurich. And through this time, yeah, I was very fortunate to work in a few companies and with a few teams that I was hardly qualified enough to join. I don't know, maybe they thought that I'm pretty or funny or something like this. And I learned a lot. I worked for many years at a company called L-Shift, I think best known as the place that sort of grew the RabbitMQ server. That's kind of claim to fame and with an amazing group of people and learned a lot. Later on at Canonical, just when sort of the community around Ubuntu was growing and the whole sort of infrastructure around that, we had a thing called Launchpad, which was kind of a precursor to GitHub as a central place to do all the open source work and build the distributions. And again, an amazing experience. I then moved to doing a lot more work around cloud and DevOps, and also leading and managing and building teams, which is something that that I also love. And worked in a few startups at a fairly early stage, kind of really getting to grow it from the beginning. Then I had almost a decade of working in the heart of the beast in big tech, joining first Google to work at Google Cloud. I've been there for a few years, and later Microsoft in Azure. Also very special, very interesting, very different experiences. And now I'm again leading a team of one in my consulting practice as an AI expert.
That's awesome. I think we are going to talk a lot about AI in this conversation. But like before we do that, I have to mention you've seen it all, right? You have seen like the major IT revolutions of the last decades. Back then when it was called Web 2.0, which meant that everyone and everything went into the web platform. Then you worked on like cloud platforms. You saw the emergence of like scalable systems and stuff like that. And then there was like a mobile revolution that took the internet in our pockets. And now, of course, there is AI. But like in more general terms, how do you think like the whole industry as such has changed over that time?
Everything got very complicated. That's the big changes I experienced when I started. When my first, actually, I I started doing kind of basic and Pascal, like Turbo Pascal, things like this. But then I discovered Visual Basic. And Visual Basic, version 2, not version 3. Version 3 was already, it was gone. But version 2 was this amazing thing. It was super simple. You could open it and you'd create an app. And there was nothing like this ever since. It just got more and more complicated, right? Now it's like
layers on layers on layers.
Straight like a distributed system with Kubernetes and whatnot. It's very complicated. And in a way, this is now happening again, right? Thanks to AI. And so you, now for the first time since the 90s, you see people who are not super proficient, not computer scientists, not very versed in engineering, having an idea and going and doing it. To me, that's very exciting.
That is. I mean, it can also like bring a lot of joy to experienced programmers back who are just like tired of all that configuration and abstraction layers that are so common these days. So like with all these changes in the industry, do you see that there's also like a shift in the skill set that is needed to like be a software engineer?
I don't think so. I mean, I think they are very specific. I mean, skill set is a big word, right? Because everyone has this bundle of different skills, and there are general transferable skills. And I think for developers, for software engineers, the main skill there is curiosity, right? And a little bit of obsession, this thing of like, again and again and again until you finally get it. And that hasn't changed, and I don't think will ever change. That's the main driver. And then there are very specific things, like when I started many years ago, there was this clear distinction between someone who develops the software and someone who, I don't know, is like a sysadmin who takes care of the servers. And that broke down, which is very good, right? It did a lot of good to our industry when that broke down with DevOps.
Absolutely.
It also means that now you can't get away with worked on my laptop. You need to understand how the whole thing works and be
absolutely
able to. And now AI is coming in. AI for quite a long time, to the extent that you can even call it AI, whatever we're doing there with machine learning, then with deep learning. It was something that specialists did, you know, data scientists, machine learning engineers. You needed fairly specialized skills that are quite a lot of effort to develop. And again, this is breaking down now, right? Everyone can use an API. Everyone's learning to do this. And it's very kind of democratized. And at the same time, everyone now is expected to have the skill set to understand how to work with software that is non-deterministic, that is a little bit quirky, very different from traditional software. So yeah, there are some changes, but what's at the heart of it is just curiosity.
Yeah, I think you just mentioned like one word, non-deterministic. I think that's the whole thing that needs to change the mindset of developers, because they're used to, like, it either works or doesn't. They're used to having unit tests or something that always run in the same fashion. And now there's something like prompt engineering and stuff. And all of a sudden, you're not even sure what is the right solution. Because as you said, like these AI systems, these large language models are non-deterministic.
Exactly, yes. And I think that the big mindset shift that people have to do is to kind of invert things, right? Because in traditional software engineering, you, in a very idealized way of it, you kind of think that you know everything in advance, right? Like, UML diagrams, right? You planned it all. You know the structures, how it will unfold.
The waterfall.
And with AI, it's kind of the opposite. You have no idea how it works. And in fact, you never will, because you cannot test it exhaustively. It's just not possible. And so you need to sort of attack it from the outside with evaluations and kind of finding experiments, basically. It's an empirical sort of science where you run experiments and until you sort of gain confidence that you know more or less how your system works. And you, even after that, you'll still always have surprises, right? It's why you continue even in production to monitor it, to learn more. What are the patterns? What are the failure modes?
Absolutely. So with that being said, would you say that like AI is just one other mini revolution in IT, just like DevOps wars or like the mobile development era wars? Or is it a buzzword, or is it like a real, real game changer that's going to change the world, how we think about software forever?
No, now we're getting a bit philosophical, right? So I think there are different ways to think about it. The direction all of them lead me is that this is one of the biggest revolutions in the history of the universe. You know, since us, since the first form of intelligence appeared. Now, the question is, how do you exactly demarcate when does this revolution start? Is it AI? Is it the internet? In a way, the AI we have today, right? If you look at these large language models, they're trained on everything in the internet. They would not exist if it wasn't for the internet. So what's the revolution here? AI or the internet? The whole thing is kind of an upgrade to intelligence in the known universe, because up until less than a century ago, the only intelligence there was in people's brains. And now there is intelligence that's growing, that's replicable. We haven't seen anything yet, right? It's only starting, but I think it's definitely not a buzzword. It's a very, very big thing that's happening.
Oh, wow. That was quite philosophical. And that was like carried a lot of meaning with that. What can we do out of that? I mean, as developers, as companies, how can we use it? Because like now everyone's using it, but also like larger companies, for example, are probably a bit more frightened with all that regulation stuff aside. So what is a good strategy for a company or an individual developer to like work with AI?
I think where I see success is when people and companies and teams are being realistic and down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
They figure out, here is this like one section of what I do. It doesn't matter if it's part of the software development process, which is where AI is having a lot of success now, or maybe it's part of the application and saying, okay, this, I'll just validate that this part can really be automated or improved using AI, and I'll do that, and I'll make sure it's like, it's never 100%, but it's like 99.999% reliable and accurate, and then I move on to the next thing. This works really well, and I'm seeing huge successes. Where it doesn't work well is when people, you know, there's a lot of hype, a lot of marketing talk around AI, a lot of promises, you know, that are not really backed by any reality. There you have a lot of disappointment, you have a lot of projects that start and kind of never land. And that's unfortunate. I think with time people will get used to this mode of working with software again, because you can't predict in advance, because it's non-deterministic, and because we don't even know the AIs, even though these are digital artifacts that have been trained by normal companies, they're more unknown than known. We don't know everything they can do in every way.
Absolutely not.
And so with time, I think more people will adjust to this way of working.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, the risk is always to kind of not be humble enough, not recognize that, hey, you don't know yet. Like, you can't make plans, right? People are used to making roadmaps and our plans for the next milestones. You can't do that. You have no idea what's going to work. You need to be honest about it. If you try to fit it into the structure of a waterfall project, you're doomed because you just have no idea what's going to happen. And you're just fooling yourself or sometimes your colleagues or your managers that you do.
So that's the ultimate test for like agile projects then.
Yes.
So you mentioned it briefly, like you started your own consulting firm all around like working with AI, solving problems with AI. So what are common problems that people or companies come to you with and ask you to help with?
So really the two strands in my work, which are a bit maybe not the same thing that you see elsewhere. One of them is really software engineering with AI assistance.
Mm-hmm.
This is an area where AI is having a lot of success. At the same time, again, there's not a lot of information. There's way too much hype and marketing and buzzwords. And it really helps to examine every part of the software development process, team. How do you integrate it all in a way that's reliable, that's repeatable, that is not just kind of ad hoc vibe coding, prompting, but actually kind of thinking of all aspects of the software development process. So that's something I'm doing quite a lot. And I'm also now getting ready to teach a course together with Isaac Flaff on this topic, where we really hope to help a much larger number of people develop a systematic approach to using AI in software development. The other strand, which to me is very interesting, I don't think that's what everyone in AI is doing, is what I call autonomous AI. So basically everything that you can do without human intervention, that happens in the background, it happens automatically.
So kind to of me, that's very agent mode.
It doesn't have to be. Well, agent is more like a marketing term, right? And
yeah.
So the question there, maybe sometimes with AI taking control and making decisions, in other cases, that's not necessary and you're just orchestrating actions with AI. But in both cases, what's interesting to me is basically to not cheat. I don't want
to sound...
to say anything bad, I know a lot of people are working on like chatbots and all kind of interactive agents, and that's all cool. I love it. I use this stuff myself, so I don't want. But to me, if I can get something to, you know, 5 nines of reliability and accuracy and dependability, and it can really be then put in orbit, do its own thing while the humans can attend to the sort of thing that only they can do. To me, that's where the value is. I'm very much focused on that.
Can we talk about that course a little bit more? Like, obviously, we don't want to do the course here in full, but what is the main thing that you teach in that course?
The main thing we teach in the course is a systematic approach to AI-assisted software development. That means, and the first sort of, we see it as like three layers, one on top of the other. The first layer is gathering context, making sure that you have a project where everything from documentation to configuration to the different rules you give AI agents, everything is in place so that you work in a way that's repeatable and systematic and accurate. Then on top of it comes the part of interactivity, where you work with agents and get them to do work on your behalf, sometimes by editing a line, sometimes by editing an entire file, sometimes by going and doing their thing for a while. And when you have that context you built on, this is becoming reliable and a bit more predictable and you're in control. And the third part, which again kind of connects to my own passion, is the things that you can do when you delegate to background agents or to actions that are running in continuous integration, and you really manage to offload some of the work to AI when you know that you can rely on it, when you you've proven to yourself, you measured that what you're doing is repeatable, reliable. So really these three layers, we think that when people understand this and adopt these approaches, adopt these tools, and we give a lot of very practical advice on how to do these things, then they can really go beyond playing around, vibe coding, enjoying themselves, which is of course also important, the creative part, to really upgrading their software development process.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned vibe coding, which is like most people probably understand like a one-shot prompt building an entire app, but probably that's not how you think AI works in larger companies or in larger software projects. You mentioned a lot about the context part of that, and like to my experience, that is the most important part of getting things to take off, actually. So I've seen like a couple of ideas, for example, with AWS or Amazon, that they released Kiro, that is another VS Code fork that helps you in AI-assisted coding in a way that it first generates some requirements documents and then it goes on with execution plans and something like that. So it when you start prompting it, it starts building its own context. Is that something that you've experimented with a bit or?
Absolutely. I have to say my own experience and my own view, and this is both in software development and in AI in general, people are over-indexing on tools.
Yeah.
And it's understandable because when everything is new, you kind of hope that, you know, there'll be something or someone takes you by the hand and show you the way. So now a lot of tools are coming with this, you know, plan mode, build mode, right? We're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, that's great, but that's a process thing. It's not a tool thing. I would rather people understand the process, understand the challenge. The challenge is AI doesn't understand things implicitly. It's not your colleague who happens to have a lifetime of experience in software and knows the project and spent, you know, many lunches with you thinking about what's the next thing to do. It just knows what's in the context. So if you don't have a clear plan and all the information necessary, you're going to get random results, basically. You don't want random results in software. That's like one thing you don't want.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Very healthy approach. Now, which tool you use for it, I don't know. It's early days. We'll still see which tools become the most prominent. But I think you don't need a tool. You can also just sit with what I do, for example, is I use an LLM. I use the code base to an LLM, and then I iterate and I write the plan. And I actually write it in a text file. No tool, nothing special until I'm happy with the plan. And then I hand it over to AI. And you don't need any tool for that. You just need to understand the importance of providing this guidance and the context.
Yeah, I just brought up that tool because like it like forces people in a way or encourages people to make that process repeatable. So it generates a lot of like what you would usually expect in an enterprise setting with like a larger team or something. As I mentioned, there were requirements documents, then there were design documents, and then finally an execution plan. And at the end, you get a report. So I'm just wondering if that is the ideal process to work with AI or if it can be much more simple.
I think that the principle is yeah, you need to have the context, you need to have the guidance. Where it's possible to make things more efficient, especially for larger projects or for larger teams, is you don't need to repeat yourself, right? That's an important principle in software. Don't repeat yourself. So if you end up writing the same information again and again in your plans, why aren't they like serialized somewhere in the rules files or in the documentation of your project, or if they are like a dynamic behavior in an MCP server, right? So there are ways to do this that are more efficient and more repeatable. But the principle remains the same. The LLM doesn't have state, doesn't have any knowledge other than the random stuff that was baked into it. So don't send it to work without knowing what it really needs to do and what it really needs to know, because you'll get random results.
Yeah, and as we already mentioned, that is absolutely not what you want. Okay. So which LLMs are you personally using? Do you see like a difference between them when it comes to coding?
I use a lot of different things. In some ways, I think the more progress there is with every new generation, there's like a core functionality that is very similar. Well, very simple things. You'll kind of delegate it to any of the strong models and you'll get similar results. And then at the edge, they have very different behavior, right? So right now, I use Gemini Pro a lot. It's really good, but it has kind of its own flavor of doing things. Whereas if I use Claude Sonnet, and I don't use the Claude Opus because it's very expensive, but if you use Claude Sonnet, it's very good at kind of going through a process. I use GPT-4.1. I really like it. It's a great model, but it's not good in this process thing, right? Like it will do one thing and it will do it really well, and then it will be like, okay, down tools.
I'm ready.
Do next. And so it really depends. And right now I'm especially excited about Qwen3 Coder. I started working with it last week. It's fantastic. It's open, which I really love. I care a lot about open source. So it's an exciting time. There's all the time new capabilities. The benchmarks don't tell you the whole story, right? Because you see the benchmarks, they're good, but then when you start using the tool, you get a feel for some things it does a bit better, some things it does less. Yeah.
So that's also an interesting part, because you talked about like democratizing the whole process, and there are open source models like Qwencoder, for example. I think K2 is also open source, or at least open weights, as well as the other one from DeepSeek. So what is going to happen? Like, is everyone running an open source model and only like the Fortune 500 companies can afford to pay for the commercial model? So what do you think will the landscape be in terms of models in the next couple of years?
It's a bit hard to tell. Yeah, I don't want to make predictions, because in AI, things are changing so fast, Alan.
Absolutely.
I'll make a fool of myself. So I want to be careful. But I think that openness, so these models, they're not really open source, right? You can't reproduce them. You can use them in a way that's more permissive and open. We started, which to me was surprising, given my history, given that I grew up with the open source movement and community and seen how the whole industry moved to open source. I was surprised to see how small a role open source played initially. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing it changing now, right? Because once there are a few credible players that are open, you can't compete with it by remaining closed. So
yeah,
there are now open models with Qwen, I think, are especially very, very exciting. The Alibaba stuff, what they're doing. And there'll be more. There was the Kimi, DeepSeek at the time. There were always a few steps behind, and I think the gap is getting narrower. And with the tooling too, I was a bit disheartened, I have to say, when I saw that some of the biggest names and the ones that captured everyone's imagination were closed tools. I thought, like, why? What justifies that? I mean, these are just like simple tools. They didn't have to spend hundreds of millions to train them. We're seeing it changing now, right? Open source is kind of, again, capturing the center. So I think we'll see more and more. I can't predict, but I would say historically what we've seen is kind of 80-20, right? Open source is dominant with kind of 80%, and then there are some specialized things that are still proprietary. I kind of expect something similar to happen, but who knows?
So that was interesting when you said the gap is narrowing. If that's the case, does that also mean like there is like an upper ceiling of what AI models might be capable of in the future?
I have no idea, but I think, yeah, this is a very philosophical question, right? Because what's the end of intelligence? Like, is there maximum intelligence? What does it even mean? And then the questions about a specific technique. Does this specific way of training models, does it scale? So far, it just gets better. So, but I don't know. And I don't know if anyone knows. Some people are a bit more bold and brave in making predictions. I'm just curious and kind of waiting to see.
I love that way of thinking. Yeah. So coming back to your course, could you tell us a bit about the modalities of it? Like, is it a live course, a video course on demand, or how do people interact with that?
No, it's a live course. It will be running the first 2 weeks of October, the first cohort. We might, depending on demand, we might do it again later. And so we'll have lectures that are kind of we talk, you listen. We'll also have lots of time for our Q&A. We're starting a community with Discord and other means of asynchronously interacting. Based on my experience, I think that's where a lot of the action is, where it gets really interesting. There'll be some take-home assignments. So it's supposed to be a lot. It's kind of designed to be a slightly intense experience, but hopefully in such a way that people can do a lot of it in their own time. Sometimes kind of bringing their own domain or their own projects and kind of trying these things out and seeing if they really get measurable improvements. That's the goal.
So how many people will there in the first cohort?
We don't know yet. So we still have 2 months to go, but given that we just opened the signups, it's a lot more than I even hoped. So it's looking quite good.
But you still have left?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, cool. And where can people find that course?
I'll send you the link. It's on Maven, so you can search there or search on my website. And I think we even have like a short link, bit.ly/AI. But I'll send you all the link, and you can add them.
Yeah, we put them in the show notes then. So, thank you. That was a very interesting, partly philosophical conversation with a lot of insights. I really appreciate that. So if people want to reach out to you, what's the best way to find you? Is it on Twitter or on LinkedIn or is it called X right now?
Yeah, on the internet. Just search Alan Noberger. It's a bit sprawling right now. I have a website that is more professional for my consulting practice. I have a Substack with a more of a personal blog where I allow myself to be a bit philosophical sometimes. GitHub, I'm always on GitHub. You'll see there's always every day some green. So come and follow or interact with me. Or on X or on LinkedIn, on Discord, it's all there. Very happy to talk to everyone. I really love the community aspect and connecting with people. So please do reach out.
Yeah, I will put all those links also in the show notes. And Eleanor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Bas. This was awesome.
It was. Thank you. Okay.